When did the labor movement begin? We generally use the Industrial Revolution as the starting point, when daytime became clock time and the needs of factories overshadowed the needs of individuals, when people were transformed into cogs in a vast, unfeeling machine working 12, 14, and even 18-hour days. Did it begin with the myriad protests and strikes against these new working conditions, whether by the Luddites, saboteurs, or tall puddle martyrs of Dorset? Did it begin with Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto of 1848, lifting the cry of "Workers of the world, unite! You have nothing to lose but your chains"? Or did it begin with the massive strike for workers' rights that produced the Paris Commune of 1871? The labor movement certainly got a boost with the founding of America's May Day movement, which we're honoring today on May 1st, in 1884 with the proclamation resolved by the Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions of the United States and Canada that 8 hours shall constitute legal days' labor from May 1st, 1886. And then the labor movement gained both momentum and gravitas in 1891 when Pope Leo XIII issued his Rerum Novarum on the conditions of the working class, demanding amelioration for the misery and wretchedness pressing so unjustly on the majority of the working class. Now, this moved the labor movement from the fringes of populist frenzy to the center of humane advocacy and had a tremendous impact on the progress. But I place the beginning of the labor movement somewhat earlier, around the year 1500 BCE, when a bunch of slaves called Hebrews escaped from Egypt, where it was believed that slaves could be treated like beasts of burden, whipped, beaten, starved, or worked to death at the whim of their masters. Only Egypt's kings, the pharaohs, were thought to be actually worthwhile because they were gods, and everyone else was considered expendable. These Hebrews came up with some audacious ideas to justify their actions. They said that they were created in the image and likeness of God, that everyone had an inherent worth instilled in them by their Creator. Everyone had a right to the kind of dignity that had previously been accorded only to kings. This was an astoundingly revolutionary idea at the time, the idea that people were worthwhile, the original humanism. My understanding of the revolutionary nature of the Hebrews' accomplishment deepened a couple of years ago when I attended a lecture by a Jewish Bible scholar. He said that those who consider themselves to be creationists, who believe that the story told in the first chapter of Genesis about how God created the universe was the literal truth, had gotten things exactly wrong. That wasn't what the story was about at all. He said that the only reason for the story about God creating the world in 7 days was to create a justification for the Sabbath, for taking one day off from work every week. This was a radical affirmation of workers' rights. In those days, when people weren't considered important, you needed to justify a change like that as being the edict of a god. I know you probably heard this text from the 20th chapter of Exodus before, maybe just the short form that Charlton Heston says in the movie. But I invite you to hear it anew this morning. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. For 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, you, your son or your daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock, or the alien resident in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, but rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and consecrated it. In 1500 BCE, to claim that no one, not even slaves or aliens, should work more than 6 days a week was an incredible advancement for workers' rights brought about by a people who had been slaves and knew firsthand what it was like to cry out for rest. The domination of the powerless by the powerful isn't limited to politics, economics, or labor, though. There's a way in which it is an inseparable element of the human condition. For example, childhood. We are all born powerless. Our very lives depend on the nurture and protection of those who care for us, usually our parents. Children are evolutionarily disposed to trust their parents, to seek their affection and approval as though their lives depended upon it. Because they do. The transition from powerlessness to power is rarely a smooth one. As a child develops a sense of itself, the first revolt against parental authority usually takes the form of what we call the terrible twos. As youngsters use their nascent sense of power to resist every wish or command they encounter. Now, how this transition is handled has a huge impact on how the child develops. If the parents interpret this as a power struggle that they need to win, the child's development is often thwarted in a way that can lead to either a lifelong resentment of authority, a deep feeling of personal powerlessness, or both. There's some interesting research on this topic on what is called learned helplessness. Martin Seligman and Steve Meyer conducted an experiment at the University of Pennsylvania in 1967. In part one of the experiment, groups of dogs were placed in harnesses yoked side by side. In these pairs, one dog would be subjected to painful electrical shocks, which that dog could end by pressing a lever. The other dog received the same shocks in parallel, but its lever wasn't connected to anything, so it couldn't stop them. Now, for these other dogs, the shock seemed random because it was the first dog's action that caused it to stop. The shocks were apparently inescapable. Now, the dogs whose actions had stopped the shocks quickly recovered from the experiment afterward, but the others learned to be helpless and exhibited symptoms similar to chronic depression. Then they took the group of dogs who had learned to be helpless and placed them in an apparatus where the dogs could escape an electrical shock by jumping over a low partition. For the most part, they simply lay down passively, whined and whimpered, even though they felt the shocks, even though they easily could have escaped. They didn't even try. Now, one very interesting thing about this is that about 1 in 3 of the dogs did not become helpless and depressed, but managed to find a way out of their unpleasant situation. It's been suggested that this correlates with the human characteristic of optimism, the ability to maintain hope in the face of evidence to the contrary. And that could be a useful survival adaptation rather than an unrealistic fantasy. The ability to maintain hope in the face of evidence to the contrary. Struggles to achieve progressive reform are often reenactments of the conflict between the optimists and the helpless. One amazing thing about how the conflict is characterized is that the helpless tend to call the optimists pessimists for claiming that there is a problem at all. One way that the helpless adapt to their situation is by convincing themselves it is normal. I believe that it is the impulses of the optimists that start the revolutions. Maintaining the status quo is often a commitment to inertia, a sign of learned helplessness. And much of the training we receive in early life teaches us to be helpless, to bow to the authority of the powerful. It's an aspect of the incredible adaptability of the human species that we are born with so little programming. We've got hungers for food, faith, hope, and love, but we have to learn how to satisfy them. Our parents teach us, but they do it by injecting their wills into us, colonizing the undeveloped countries of our souls with their values, ideas, and assumptions. Of course, it's for their good. We parents, you know, spend all these years learning what our children need to know. But one of the hallmarks of maturity is the ability to delay the gratification of our desires by developing a personality strong enough to resist our own impulses. But when we learn to endure pain, deny our own happiness, and distrust others' motives, that very teaching can pervert our basic impulses toward faith, hope, and love by turning them upside down. It takes a certain amount of modification to turn an unfettered, naive, and carefree child into a disciplined student. Faith has to bind to obedience. Hope has to bind to achievement. And love has to bind to approval. Each step forward in life can bring another set of modifications grafted onto the original programming of the human spirit. Layer upon layer can accumulate so that by the time one enters the workplace, there may be little of the optimist left. The rewards of the workplace often have very little to do with faith, hope, or love. The workplace itself can be a place of colonization. We have to accept a set of artificial inducements, rewards, and punishments in order to accept, to adapt to the workplace. And because humans are designed to survive in a wide variety of situations, including incredible adversity, we have the capability to accept harsh and hurtful working conditions as normal. When we Unitarian Universalists promote the use of reason to guide against the idolatries of the mind and spirit, we need to be careful to examine our most basic beliefs to see if they are in harmony with our deepest innate potential. Some of the most harmful ideologies and idolatries can stand the test of reason once you've accepted their assumptions. We need to feel clearly with our hearts as well as think clearly with our minds if we are going to nurture the faith, hope, and love and fulfillment that is our birthright. On this May Day weekend, it seems appropriate to recall times when people have struggled to throw off demeaning and hurtful beliefs about what it means to do work. The Hebrews escaped from slavery in Egypt as an enduring symbol of the triumph of the human spirit over economic subjugation. Another time was the emergence of the American Union movement, when there was growing outrage over the hours, pay, and conditions as people realized they were sacrificing their lives to economic interests, the goals of which did not include their well-being. In 1909, women and children in the garment industry could be expected to work 14 hours a day and 12 on Saturday in crowded, dangerous conditions for little pay and no overtime. The International Ladies' Garment Workers Union went on strike for better pay, shorter hours, and safer working conditions. The strike was supported not only by labor and the Socialist Party, but by the wealthy women of New York who saw the issue in terms of feminism and justice. They were nicknamed the Mink Brigade. The conscience of society was aroused, but the owners were not convinced. They eventually granted a minor compromise in pay and working hours, but insisted that they had the right to run their businesses as they saw fit. Then, just over 100 years ago, on March 25th, 1911, New York City experienced the worst factory fire in its history. At the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, 500 women were employed there, mostly Jewish immigrants between the ages of 13 and 23. The exits had been blocked to keep the women at their sewing machines and prevent theft. And the foreman with the key fled for safety without unlocking the doors. The fire, fed by tons of fabric, spread rapidly. Panicked workers rushed to the stairs, freight elevator, fire escape. 146 souls died. Some trapped where they worked, many burnt in heaps by the exit doors, others falling to their deaths as the one exterior fire escape collapsed under their weight. The public outcry was overwhelming. 80,000 people marched in a funeral procession for the women who had died. But even in the public revulsion and anger over the conditions that had led to the fire, many still defended the right of shop owners to resist government safety regulations. But this fire led to the establishment of the New York Bureau of Fire Investigation, which gave the fire department authority over factory safety. The 1911 fire wasn't only a catalyst for fire safety regulation. It also boosted the union movement in general, as it sought to lift up the rights and dignity of working women and men, asserting that people had inherent worth and dignity that went beyond their economic usefulness, and that people should be able to live and work in ways that permitted happiness and fulfillment, as well as mere survival. But you know, 80 years later, on the morning of September 4th, 1991, a 25-foot-long fryer vat burst into flames in the Imperial Chicken Processing Plant in Hamlet, North Carolina. Workers, normally subjected to intense heat and long hours without adequate rest periods, suddenly found themselves trapped in a burning building. Cries of, "Let me out, let me out," were heard as they tried to kick open the fire doors that had been locked to prevent vandalism and theft. 25 people died that morning, another 49 injured. Due to a shortage of safety inspectors, the plant had never been inspected. The aftermath of this fire led to increased diligence and state inspections, but the fire was perceived as an isolated criminal act rather than the logical consequences about the nature of work that were held by many, workers and employees alike. And so it goes. The job of the garment workers' strike is still not yet done. One of the activists of that strike of 1909, Rose Schneiderman, explained that better pay was not enough, that working women needed enough free time and security to enjoy life as well. She used flowers, roses, to symbolize the finer things that even a common life could enjoy, saying, "The worker must have bread, but she must have roses too." Our closing hymn today was inspired by those words. Written in the aftermath of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, it became the battle hymn for the women's union movement, sung by tens of thousands who joined in the fight for human worth and dignity. I invite you all to rise as you're able and join in hymn number 109 as we come marching, marching.